Welcome to the Astrophys Podcasts. My name is Brendan O'Brien, and first of all, we would like to acknowledge Australia's first astronomers, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the traditional owners and custodians of the land we are on. This episode is produced on Yorta Yorta and Wurundjeri country of the Kulin Nation. And we'd also like you to influence your local politicians to do more to mitigate climate change by moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. We're now in our ninth year of production with over 180 fabulous interviews with top scientists from all over the world. Each month, we produce two fabulous episodes. On the first of each month, Dr. Ian Astroblog Musgrave gives us his monthly sky guide, plus a unique astrophotography challenge. Then, on the 15th of each month, we publish an interview with a leading astronomer, astrophysicist, space scientist, data scientist, telescope engineer, project manager, or particle physicist, and we discover their science journey and rare insights into how they think and conduct their amazing research into exactly how our universe works. Our audio files and transcripts are available on our website at astrophys.com, and MP3s can be freely streamed from SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts. Today I'm at the Transients Down Under Conference, known affectionately as the TDU Conference, in Melbourne, Australia. It's the first face-to-face astrophysics conference to be held in Australia since COVID hit us back in 2020. It's great to see a couple of hundred delegates and invited speakers here meeting and sharing their research in person in such an exciting environment here at the Swinburne University of Technology. And a big shout out to Ashley and Jeff who allowed me to attend and record some interviews. I'm recording in a repurposed planetarium, which is very live with lots of hard timber and glass surfaces. And the space I'm in is also near one of the lecture theatres. So you will probably hear one of the speakers in the background occasionally. I hope it's not too much of a distraction. Today, listeners, we're here on Wurundjeri land. I'm sitting with Professor Katie Ocatel, who is the Associate Professor of Astrophysics and Physics from Melbourne University. And we're also very excited to be with Katie at the conference, of course. Katie is an observational astrophysicist whose research focuses on the extreme death of stars. And since doing a first degree here, Katie has been away studying at some of the world's most prestigious institutions and doing groundbreaking research using the most powerful Earth and space-based instruments to observe both distant and nearby cataclysmic events across the entire electromagnetic spectrum. She has a swag of awards and prizes and done her postdoc at Ohio State University, and she's been Assistant Professor at Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen and is currently an assistant adjunct professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's also currently the PI of a large Australian Research Council grant looking at tidal disruption events, known affectionately as TDEs, where stars get ripped apart by supermassive black holes. I may even get a chance to ask her to explain spaghettification later. Katie's worked on a sensational book we'll hear about. It's for aspiring astrophysicists that's just been freely published on the archive server. I'll give you the link for that and we'll hear about that from Katie. But until then, here she is back in Melbourne on the local organising committee of this amazing TDU conference here. And we're hearing about the very latest breakthroughs in transient astronomy and all the spin-offs that are emerging from this sensational science. Thanks for speaking with us today, Katie.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be able to talk to you.
Okay, before we talk about your current research in the Transients Down Under Conference, can you tell us about growing up in Melbourne, please, Katie? And
Could you tell us how you first became interested in science and space?
Yeah, so I was very lucky to grow up in Melbourne, and, you know, I lived actually not very far from where we are today and where we're doing the conference. But one of the advantages of living in the Southern Hemisphere, as we all know, is that we get these beautiful access to the sky, right, which is completely, you know, very dark skies that allow us to see all, you know, the Milky Way and the nearby galaxies, the LMC and the SMC, and just to see the beauty of the sky. And so growing up, I was lucky enough that I got that my family was very accommodating of science and very much promoting that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, you should be able to access this and, you know, get to learn about this. And through their encouragement and, you know, just being exposed to a lot of different things, were I lucky enough to kind of start getting excited about science. When I was very young, I was very excited about rockets. I really wanted to be an astronaut. That was my thing. But of course, you know, Australia doesn't, or at that time, didn't have a space agency or a program, so it's not a common thing. So at that time, it was mostly just having fun with, you know, looking at stars and seeing what can be done. And so, you know, of course, as I grew up, I didn't really know that you could do astronomy as a subject, right? I just kind of thought it was fun. And I was kind of just excited about learning how things work, right, and why things are the way they happen to be. And, you know, probably to my parents' detriment, pull things apart a lot and not be able to put them back together, you know, because you always forget that one screw or something like this. But just, you know, having supportive people around you and who allowed me to kind of explore the world was kind of what kind of led me into doing science. And I, you know, it wasn't until very later, until university, did I realize I could do astronomy. But at this, you know, at that time, I was kind of excited about chemistry and biology and, you know, physics. It was kind of all just fun things that you could apply. You know, take maths that you're learning in high school and try to apply it to bigger problems to understand, you know, how light works or, you know, how different things work. So it was kind of just curiosity really just led me onto a science path, and of course, a very supportive family.
What about those early ambitions?
So in terms of coming out of high school, I knew I wanted to do a science degree. What I actually wanted to do was not clear at that point, but I just was like, I want to do science. And then from there, I just wanted to kind of see what I'm interested in and what is available to see the options, because going from high school to university is quite a different world and you get a completely, you know, wide option, many options available to you. And so I went, you know, I was lucky enough to get into a science degree at Monash University, and I went there and I, you know, picked physics and astronomy and maths and chemistry. That's kind of what I picked. But I only did one subject of astronomy because at that time I really was really excited about physics. And why I was excited about physics at that time was that I found it really difficult. And because it was so difficult, I spent a lot of time trying to do well at it. And I didn't do very well. In my first year, I only just passed these subjects. But because it was a bit of a challenge, I put a lot of time into effort in that. And I met a good group of peer students. And I think that's really important, having a good group of students together who are in your group, that we kind of worked on these problems together, and having that community that, you know, help support going through a very tough subject, because I'm not going to say first year physics is not easy at all, kind of led me to be kind of like, this is fun, right? It's fun because it's a challenge. It's fun because of the community that I can work with, which was my friends and everything. And then trying to, you know, that kind of proudness, like, oh, I solved this. Not saying it wasn't easy at all. But at that time, I didn't really know physics was the direction. But later on, kind of as I got into second year, I was like, oh, you know, theoretical physics, I really kind of like that you can apply these mathematical, you know, mathematical structures to try to understand the fundamentals of physics. And so at that time, I was thought, oh, maybe I want to do theoretical physics. Maybe I'll do like an honors degree, theoretical physics. And I actually did this. And then I was like, I'll make a decision on what I'll do after that. So that's kind of the direction that I went. But as you're talking to me now and as you introduced me, I'm not in theoretical physics anymore. And that's kind of connected a little bit to kind of the pathway I took.
Okay, well, let's take it from there. After that first bachelor's degree with honours in physics and maths at Monash, you flew over to one of the most prestigious institutes in the world for the study of theoretical physics, and It was in Ontario, and you did your master's there, and that was at the famous Perimeter Institute. Mm-hmm. It's a very powerful place to learn. And then you came back to Monash for your PhD, and we know we have a lot of astro students, undergrads, and early career astronomers listening. Could you tell us how you arranged to do your master's over at the Perimeter Institute?
Yeah, so actually it's a lot of back to front type of thing. So like I said, I was planning to do theoretical physics. That was kind of what I thought I originally wanted to do. And I started off in the, you know, did my honours, and I actually applied to the PhD program at Monash and got into the PhD program to do theoretical physics at that time. And but because of the difference between the school years between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, there's a 6-month difference. And so while I was in my honours year, I had also applied to this master's program because I was like, oh, I don't know what the next step is. And because of the delay, I didn't know that I had got into the master's program. And I thought, oh, they probably have offered it to somebody else. You know, that's totally fine. This is what it is. I'll do my PhD. But then I got offered this master position at the master's program. And so luckily what I could do, and, you know, the department was very supportive of this, is that I could actually take a year off my PhD. So I paused my PhD at that time, and was able to go over to Canada to be able to do my master's at the Perimeter Institute, because they have this particular program called the PSI program, which is the Perimeter Scholars International program, which is essentially a 2-year master's compressed into about 1 year. And so it's a lot of coursework, you do a bit of research, and it's kind of like a crash course in theoretical physics. And so I was like, okay, this is a great opportunity. If I was going to start a PhD in theoretical physics, this seems natural that I should go do a crash course in theoretical physics topics and then come back, and then I can do my PhD. And so I went over, and it was really wonderful. We had an amazing cohort of students that we work with. We were very lucky to be kind of, you know, you're at this particular institute, which kind of just engages you completely, because you're just in, you're in the center of all the theoretical physics at that time. And, you know, it's very overwhelming, but also very kind of inspiring too. When I was doing this, even though I really enjoyed doing this, I realized I enjoyed doing the subjects and, you know, learning about this. I realized I wanted something more observational or data driven. And astronomy seemed like the very natural pathway to go, because I actually started working on a project related to particle physics, using pulsars and supernova remnants to try to understand particle acceleration in there, because these objects are actually nature's particle accelerators. And so I decided that actually, you know, maybe not pursuing pure theoretical physics, probably not for me. I'm probably not able to do that as well as other people, but, you know, having a mix of astronomy and that. So when I went back at Monash after finishing this, with the help of my supervisors I had at that time, actually found another supervisor who actually had the strong astro component that overlapped with the particle research, or the, you know, particle acceleration that I was kind of after, the astronomy side. And I applied to this program called the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory pre-doctoral program that is held at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so in Boston. The person who, you know, allowed me to work with them during this time, and, you know, became one of my supervisors, and I was able to essentially spend my time working with him at the Smithsonian at CFA, learning about particle acceleration using supernova remnants and everything, but kind of combining some of the fundamentals that I had learned in my master's and undergrad from that theoretical perspective, but applying it to more data. And once I kind of started doing that, I realized I was actually really excited about astronomy. I was really excited about observations, because I was able to use space telescopes doing this, which is kind of, you know, if you ask little baby Katie, right, it still blows my mind I can do this now, right? I would never have believed it, but being able to play with that data, get to see these type of beautiful explosions that you can look at and really try to piece together, you know, the particle acceleration processes, but also understanding the life and death of stars. And once that kind of happened, that kind of got me hooked, and I went, okay, I want to change direction of my PhD. And I was just lucky enough, I had support from my supervisor at CFA and supervisors at Monash, that I could actually just completely be like, no, scrap it, let's go with this other direction. So I kind of started in astronomy maybe like 6 months into my PhD, which I think is not the traditional way of doing a degree in astronomy, because I did very little in leading up to this. And I was just lucky enough to have the support to be able to do that.
Fantastic. What a trajectory. That sounds like a crash course in theoretical physics. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a vertical learning curve to me. And
it was not easy. It was not easy. I look back and I'm very, very impressed that we could do it. But, you know, to be able to get to that point, I had a lot of support from a lot of people, right? A lot of good mentors who were able to allow me to take, take these opportunities, right? Because that's kind of what, you know, really helped a lot. And then that kind of just set everything on there. And I've just been very lucky since then to have a lot of great people who have supported me and come across a number of opportunities that have kind of led me to being able to sit here and be able to talk to you right now.
Sensational. Look, we've got the backstory now and we're going to focus on the science. And I had a quick look at your PhD and looked up your latest discoveries in your work and your ARC project and the Astrophysics Guidebook and the TDU conference. But first, do you want to tell us what's the big picture about supernovas and TDEs, tidal disruptive events? And most of our regular listeners will have heard a lot about supernovas here, but it's always good to have a recap. Can you give us a quick supernova definition? And could you give us an outline of what tidal disruptive events are?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. So my research at the moment encompassing, I just love things that explode, right, and get ripped apart. So that's kind of where I'm really excited. And seeing what you can do to kind of piece together the crime scene to understand what happened before it died. So that's kind of, you know, we make the joke that we're like stellar morticians, or we're, you know, stellar investigators trying to say, well, we have this, you know, we have the leftover remains of things. What does that mean about the life before that star, unfortunately, died? So what is a supernova? Well, a supernova is essentially a star or a white dwarf, which is essentially a very compact part of the star that was couldn't progress from oxygen all the way up to iron, because in the belly of the star you have hydrogen and helium that gets converted to heavier and heavier elements. But whether you can get up to all the way up to iron, which is the most stable element, depends on the mass of the star. But a supernova is essentially that violent endpoint of the life of a star. And that essentially is when the star can either not process any more material inside its belly, because essentially it's used up all its fuel, or, essentially it's maximized its ability to be able to convert anything like this, or it's just too heavy to hold itself anymore. And so what happens, it can either collapse on itself in something called a gravitational collapse, and that produces a core collapse explosion. And so that usually happens for stars that are at least 8 times the mass of our sun.
So that's core collapse. What other sorts of supernovas are there, Katie?
So there are a few types of supernovas. There is something called a core collapse, which comes from these massive stars at least 8 times of our sun that collapses once an iron core is formed at the centre. Or you have these thermonuclear explosions, or type 1A supernova explosions. And what happens is that comes from a star, a white dwarf, which is essentially a little baby star that was not able to progress in its thermonuclear evolution to be able to go all the way up to iron. So it actually stopped at oxygen. But what happens is those little white dwarfs kind of can find another partner, because all stars like to be with a partner, and they can either accrete material from that nearby star and get too heavy. And then what happens when it gets too heavy, it rips apart. Or the other possibility that we think is that you actually can find another white dwarf, because like I said, and it can do this kind of magical dance around each other and kind of get very close to each other and explode, right? Because they kind of collide into each other, and that's a thermonuclear explosion. And they're all very interesting through different ways and how you can use them. They really tell you kind of like different parts about the endpoints of stellar evolution and how stars and live and die. There's something quite magical about what, you know, understanding life after death in these aspects.
Fantastic. And TDEs?
Yeah, so TDEs are a completely new way of trying to probe stellar evolution in the thing. So there's a few directions with tidal disruption events. So tidal disruption events are when a very unlucky star just gets a little bit too close to a black hole and kind of gets ripped apart by the black hole, because the black hole has really strong forces on there and the little star just can't survive that. So what happens is it rips it apart and that star gets accreted onto the black hole, and this actually causes a luminous flare, a very multi-wavelength bright flare at the heart of a galaxy, so associated with the black hole, that you can then use to try to probe a few things, but most importantly you can use them to probe black holes that are not active. So most black holes you see in the sky are very loud in the sense that they're very bright and they twinkle a lot, right? So they're kind of going all over, their brightness is changing, which means that they're actively eating. It's kind of like an angry toddler is the best way to think of it. But there are a lot of black holes very close to us at the center of galaxies that are actually kind of quiet, what we call quiescent or, you know, inactive, because they're not doing that really active variability that you look at. But to be able to kind of probe those, it's a little harder than some of the techniques we usually use for these more active, they're more active cousins. So we can actually use these unlucky stars in their final throes of their life to try to probe the black hole, because what happens when you accrete material onto the black hole, you actually invigorate the black hole again, because now it's suddenly getting, you know, a big meal, right, from that thing, and you can actually now see and probe the properties of that black hole. So it's like a complete new way of being able to understand black holes relatively close to us that are completely not active, while also allowing us to try to understand stars' evolution in different galaxies that are far away, because, you know, now you can probe the properties of the star being ripped, because you get to see those signatures in data that you all get. And the thing is that at that time, those stars are not necessarily at the very end point of their life, right? They're just unlucky enough that they just got thrown or somehow accommodated close to the black hole. And so you can kind of probe different parts of the stellar evolution in a different way, because now that star's being ripped apart, so you can see what's in the belly of the star, which is really hidden from us. So you think, like, when you look at the sun, you can't see what's going on in there, but if you rip that star apart, you can now start to see what's going on. And so it gives us a very different view of star evolution thing, but also allows us to probe black holes at the same time.
Fantastic. Here we are, listeners. I'm at the TDU conference with Katie Alcatel, and she's obviously, from that last explanation, she's a forensic cosmologist. No, a forensic astronomer.
Yes.
Look, when I was doing the research for this, I saw an interesting term called spaghettification. What is spaghetti? It sounds delicious.
It's a little bit more violent than how it sounds, unfortunately. So it's just a word for essentially when you're in a very strong force field, so such as a gravitational wave that you would, oh, not gravitational wave, close to a gravitational force, such as like what you would get close to black holes, which have extreme forces if you get close to them. And what happens, the spaghettification, which is a very hard word to say, and I always struggle to do it, is essentially when you have like a star or something like this, it gets kind of pulled kind of long ways and like horizontal and vertically into kind of very long strips, right? Into what you would expect spaghetti looks like, right? And so that's kind of what it happens to be. And so it's a very violent process. Nothing will survive this. And with tidal disruption events, that's what people kind of think, is that you, these stars, as they get closer, they, you know, we think of stars as very circular, but as they get closer and closer to those extreme forces of the black hole, you find, or like simulations have kind of shown, that they kind of get stretched and pulled in these vertical and horizontal ways and many other dimensions as well, because it's obviously 3D, but you get kind of these strips that then lead to kind of that spaghettification of the star. So yes, very delicious sounding, but probably not something we want to deal with on a daily basis.
Okay, thanks Katie. We'll stay away from the event horizon. Okay, let's have a quick look back at your PhD. I found your thesis on the Monash website. It's the incandescent remains of stellar death. Here we are, your forensics astronomy. And you were using cosmic X-ray data. I mean, you were using cosmic ray data, X-ray and gamma ray data to look at the remnants, as you mentioned, of supernovas. And he also used the Chandra X-ray Observatory to do a biopsy on a pulsar. You were using high-energy physics and these really powerful instruments to probe those distant high-energy cataclysmic events. I know you're not allowed to have favourites. Certainly haven't with my kids, but do you have a suite of favourite instruments that are doing normal, productive, heavy lifting, getting all that really valuable data for you?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, absolutely, of course. So it still blows my mind that I can use telescopes in space. And so because I did a lot of my PhD work and still have done a lot on X-ray astronomy, because X-ray astronomy allows you to be able to, or X-ray wavelengths allow you to actually probe the stellar ejecta. So essentially those materials that the star is producing, they actually glow in X-ray wavelengths because essentially they've been what we call shock heated. So the explosion produces a very strong shock that interacts with the material that came from the star, that from the belly of the star, and that heats it up to X-ray temperatures, and so you can actually see what was going on inside the star in X-ray wavelengths. And so, you know, Chandra and XMM, and particularly Chandra because it's very high resolution and allows you to kind of see and actually map out spatially across the sky all this information of where the material is thrown out, so how does it explode, where is it located, how quickly it moved away from, say, the centre of the, where we expect the centre of explosion. And so Chandra has a really strong, you know, it's like an instrument I first learnt on. It's the first image that kind of got me into astronomy, got me into doing this kind of thing. So that always kind of gets me really excited, being able to use Chandra. But more recently, there's another telescope called the Swift Telescope as well. And this is a beautiful telescope because it's a tiny little baby telescope that observes in multiple wavelengths at once. So it observes in X-rays, but it also observes in optical and UV at the same time. And so that's amazing because it allows you to probe very different parts of the physical processes that occur in different transients or different phenomena that you look at. And it's very quick. So if, let's say, a supernova or your favorite type goes off right now, if you submit something called a target of opportunity, which essentially says, oh, this is really cool, please can we look at it, right? Please, you know, your please is giving all the science of why that's really interesting. They will be able to point that telescope at that source very quickly. So it can be on source in like an hour or like very, it's right, depends on the source. And it can just observe in these multiple wavelengths. And so it can tell you in one go about multiple parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is completely different from being able to only look and say one wavelength. So it kind of gives you that kind of insight, which is quite amazing that you can then use for quite a lot of different sciences. So SWIFT really is a beautiful instrument as well that I use a lot at the moment, I think. But of course, more recently, I've been able to use a lot of ground-based telescopes as well, because anytime there's a telescope to use, I'm always very excited to be able to use it and play with new data. But particularly on the ground at the moment, they're at Siding Springs here in Australia, which is a very beautiful place. So if you ever got the opportunity, please go and visit it. The instrument I'm really excited about using at the moment is called the 2.3-meter Wives telescope, and it's an optical telescope that can essentially take optical spectra of different sources that go off. And the nice part about this source is that apart from being able to observe just the transient or the thing, it also gets to observe the environment at the same time. So you kind of get like a 2-for-1 deal. And it's very nice because it's, you know, the people at Siding Springs are just amazing, being able to support the observatory there. But they actually, you know, they are able to, they've made it such that they can actually make it quite easy for students and also, you know, myself, who've used a number of telescopes, to be able to kind of get into it very quickly. And it's recently become robotic because the whole idea is it's going to now move on to be kind of like a powerhouse for transient science. So anything that goes bump in the night, it wants to be able to do. So this is stars, supernova, tidal disruption events, whatever. It's robotic, which means that you just tell it, I want to look at this fun thing that's really cool. Right, and it kind of programs to look at the night, right? So in the morning, you know, I submit the observations, say the night before, and in the morning I can wake up and there's data for me to look at. And so that's, you know, that's a very privileged position to be in and very lucky, and it's amazing the support that the people at Siding Springs and at ANU have been doing, but it's been kind of revolutionary for a lot of the science that we're able to actually do together.
Fantastic.
I know that was a very long thing, but there is a lot of great science, a lot of great telescopes to do a lot of great science.
Yeah, it's nice to hear there's an instrument where you don't have to queue up for years to get some time on it.
Yes, no, we're very lucky in Australia that they're very, you know, the community, we have a lot of really great resources like the Anglo-Australian Telescope and this 2.3-metre telescope and many others that we can actually get access to. Of course, there's tons of radio as well, but of course I do mostly optical x-rays, so I'm a little bit biased, but we're very privileged in Australia because we have a very strong foundation in astronomy in Australia.
Fantastic, okay. Look, this brings us right up to the present now. You've got a huge number of publications. I found about 114 when I had a quick look. I did a quick search, and one of your most recent ones jumped out at me. It was supernova SN2023-IXF, and it was discovered recently in the Pinwheel Galaxy, which is just a beautiful optical galaxy. What was the data telling you about this supernova?
Yes, so 2023 IXF is a beautiful supernova because it's the closest supernova in the decade, right? So it's kind of amazing for that because one of the things that we're most interested in is trying to piece together those final stages of stellar death, so essentially what's happening to the star prior to its death and what it looked like and what its environment happens to be and what's it doing prior to it explodes. And so if you're very close to us, right, close here being relative because obviously we're on large scales, because if I remember correctly, the Pinwheel Galaxy is about 15 million light years away or something, or 6.4 kiloparsecs, no, not megaparsecs away. I'm sure I've got that wrong, but it's about approximately that, but it's really close, right?
Whereabouts in the sky is it?
It's in the northern hemisphere, so unfortunately we can't observe it from the southern hemisphere, so we rely either on space-based telescopes to do this, or you have to use resources in the north. But, you know, even though we're in the southern hemisphere, that doesn't matter. We still do great science. So it is the closest. And so because it's the closest, it's been observed many times, apart from it being an incredibly beautiful image, right? This beautiful spiral galaxy that's face on, that sees beautiful star formation all the time. But because of this, there's been many, many archival observations of this source. And so the fact that it's so close to us means that we can go look at all that archival data previously and then be like, what was there before it exploded, right? And try to understand essentially the progenitor or the star before it died. And so this nice work that was led by the PhD student I'm working with, Sonia, she actually looked at trying to understand if there was any evidence prior to the explosion that the star that was there was actually going to explode or not. And so what we did is that we looked at multi-wavelength data. So we looked at X-rays, we looked at optical and UV data to see if there was any hint that a star was going to die. Because stars, massive stars, which is what this source comes from, I should have prefaced that. This is a core collapse of a very massive star, and we think it's about 15 times the mass of our sun. Before these massive stars tend to die, they don't go quietly into the night, right? So what happens is that they tend to be, they kind of strip their outer layers of mass that they have. And so they kind of very actively have things called episodic mass loss events. And so what we expect that would be is that you may see some flaring, so optical changes in the optical brightness at that position prior to the actual explosion. And we've seen this for a handful of things before the actual thing, and these are called precursor events. Or you might find that actually there's a very strong wind that is just kind of throwing out material constantly, but at a very high rate, higher than what you see kind of now, you know, with our sun, right? It's like very constantly as it leads up, and this gets more and more extreme as it gets closer to the explosion. And so we were looking for evidence of that would hint at this, and the answer is we didn't see anything. So it doesn't mean that it didn't do this type of thing, but it just was either below our observing limits that we could see with our data, or maybe it does it in a slightly different way, or maybe it was too shrouded. So what happens when, you know, if you throw out a lot of material, right, you shroud yourself. So we may not have just seen it because there's too much material in the way. And so what Sonia was looking at was trying to see if we could see evidence and what that meant in terms of the brightness, like what's the maximum brightness of it, of mass loss, but also trying to understand how much mass is lost. And so because we didn't find any evidence, we put a limit on how much material was thrown out by that star. But the thing is that you can actually also use the properties of the light after the supernova to probe the mass loss history. So how much it threw it, even if you didn't see any explosion or like anything that hinted that it was losing mass prior. Because what happens is, like I said, the star will actively throw out material into the environment, and that material is around the star, and it slowly moves it and moves out. So it's kind of like an onion in some aspect. Of course, it's three-dimensional, but it's for, you know, visualization. Say it's kind of like an onion, and, you know, you're adding more layers as the star evolves, and the stuff that's closest to the star is the stuff that was most recently thrown out by the star. So the closest to its death, right? And as you go further away from the star, that's kind of like much more in its history. So when the shock front from the explosion goes out, it reprobes the mass loss from what was most recent to what occurred very far away. And so we were monitoring the evolution of the light curve and essentially of monitoring the evolution of this shock interacting with that mass that had been thrown out previously. Because what happens is when you have lots of material and you have a shock front, so some energy interacting, right? No different to when I, right? You get a bright light, right? Because you're running, something's running into a thing. And this occurs in X-ray wavelengths. And so this is where we're using the Swift telescope. And so we could monitor when the shock interaction occurred, so when it first hit something, and then also then start monitoring as the shock is kind of plowing through that old material and say how much material was thrown out, how much did it throw out, over what time scale, when was this material likely thrown out prior to its death. And so we were kind of piecing together the history of its life before it died. So that's kind of what we were doing in that paper.
Oh, my head just exploded. Thank you, Katie. That's sensational. You're generating this huge level of understanding from such a small amount of data. It's beautiful science. It's fantastic.
It's absolutely wonderful, right? And I'm so lucky that I get to work at it. It blows my mind that I can, you know, figure, you know, not to use a cliche, but that one can actually kind of probe these kind of fascinating events using, relatively small amounts of data and really understand the endpoints of life, of all the life before a star died, and understand the life prior to this. I don't think I would have had, you know, like I said, you asked little Katie thing that I could do this. It's still very privileged to be and lucky to be in this position.
Unbelievable. Okay. Let's move on now and have a look at your current project, Awakening Giants in Galaxies, using stars to probe supermassive black holes. Now, who's in your team? Well, we know what you're doing from the title of it, but what's the methodology for this and your hopes, and how's it going, Katie?
Yes, so this project, so using stars to reinvigorate black holes, kind of ties to these tidal disruption events. So what I'm in this project, the aim of the project is try to see if we can find and discover these tidal disruption events to try to probe, one, characterize the stellar populations close to black holes, so understanding the stars that are getting thrown in, understanding the host galaxies, so what type of black holes like to eat stars more than other black holes, and then try to see if we can use these unlucky stars to try to probe black hole masses. Because one of the biggest questions is trying to understand black hole masses, right? What are the black hole masses in the local universe? How do they correlate with the sizes of our galaxies? And if they're quiescent, like I had said, if they're not like these active cousins that we usually look for, we have to find other ways to be able to probe those masses. And these stellar disruptions allow us, or these tidal disruption events allow us to do this. And so if we can find enough of them in our nearby galaxy, we can kind of understand the galaxy distribution of black holes, supermassive black holes in our local universe, and be able to kind of understand how that changes as a function of distance from us, so in terms of redshift, and really try to understand the fundamentals of the black hole itself and how it eats and accretes, because it's kind of a, you know, the black hole's quiet and then you feed it something and you form what we call an accretion disk, which is essentially just all its food is around at the black hole at that time. And you can see that kind of form in real time, which gives you completely different types of insight into black holes and accretion in these extreme environments that we don't really necessarily get from their more active cousins, or in a slightly different way. And so the key of the project is try to find them, characterize them, these TDEs, properly, because one of the hardest parts about doing tidal disruption event science is that black holes don't care what they eat, whether it's a star or something that was already there. So it's very hard to differentiate them, or like you need a little bit more work to get there. But also we don't really understand these active cousins in terms of whether they're always on, so they're always active, or whether they turn off for some period and then they become more active or not. So trying to piece together what is actually an active black hole that just was a little bit quiet for that moment, just took a break, or whether it actually is a, you know, pure quiescent black hole that then was a star coming in, is trying to piece that information together. So there's kind of a multifaceted aspect of this project. And so I'm lucky enough to have a master's student currently working with me at Melbourne, Jennifer. She's working on one that we think is a repeating tidal disruption event. So the star, it's called Assassin 14KO, which essentially is a star that we think is going around a black hole that's kind of being nibbled. Instead of being just completely disrupted and accreted, it's slowly being nibbled as it orbits around the black hole. So you kind of see, you can predict when it's flaring. So you can actually study this. And we're trying to work out, you know, is that what's happening to that poor star that's been occurred? How quickly is that nibbling at the star? You know, can we find more of those? So that's what Jennifer's working on at the moment. But I also am lucky in my position is that I get to, and, you know, also a lot of the people here at this conference, is that I get to work with a lot of international collaborators as well. And so this is a part of some big surveys that I'm a part of, optical surveys that are looking for transients, where we're trying to essentially find these tidal disruption events and coordinate observations. So one of the very lucky parts of my job is I get to talk to people around the world nearly every single day, because we're coordinating observations, we're finding new discoveries, and we're trying to kind of piece together this picture of what's happening to these stars, what's happening in these black holes altogether. And this is kind of one aspect of the whole project.
Fantastic. Okay. Now, we know that science doesn't always run smoothly.
Absolutely.
It's a real roller coaster sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
What's something you're working on at the moment that's driving you crazy or is really blowing your mind? You've mentioned a few things already. What's going on, Katie?
So, like I mentioned previously, the thing that is driving me not crazy, but probably crazy in a good way, is trying to separate these TDEs from all these tidal disruption events from these active black holes. Because it's so hard to know whether something is coming from a black hole, these active cousins versus not, it's trying to work out ways to be able to understand this. And what nature likes to do is they like, you know, you think you've worked it out, you know, nature always, there's always something else that kind of comes into here, which of course keeps our job interesting. And more recently, we've come across a lot of events or transient events that we thought were traditionally probably tidal, had features of tidal disruption events, but they actually occur in galaxies that we know have a very active black hole. So we call them ANTs, or ambiguous nuclear transients, because they have properties of both things, but they seem to kind of fall in more into a little bit of these TD, you know, tidal disruption events, but sometimes maybe a bit more into these active thing. And we don't really know. So the thing is that what that seems to suggest is that there's probably a continuum of tidal, you know, a tidal disruption event, kind of a mix, maybe a tidal disruption event occurring in an AGN, going towards more of these active features and trying to piece together this continuum and try to understand, well, when is a TDE, when is a tidal disruption event actually a tidal disruption event? Or is it actually something that's more in this ambiguous part? Or can it occur more than once or not? So trying to piece that together is kind of frustrating, because you think you understand it and then absolutely not. Because if I think back to some work I did in 2018 or 2017, what we thought of TDEs there, I would say, is very different from what we think now. Because originally we thought tidal disruption events, it's in a quiescent galaxy, no evidence. It's a very smooth rise to its peak brightness, and then it decays very smoothly. 100% that's a tidal disruption event. But now we're seeing more, as we've got better and better at finding these sources, and our surveys have become better and more efficient at doing this, we find more and more of things that look like TDEs but may not be TDEs, are kind of in between. It's like this, which is kind of a very fun part, because of course it shouldn't be easy, but it just kind of like now it's, you know, what you think one time will be it, you have to go back and try to sort out. So it's kind of piecing together all that information to understand. So that's kind of what's you know, making me excited but also a little frustrated when looking at what's going on.
And here we are getting astronomical forensics and genealogy. Thanks, Kate. Okay. Look, what about your non-research work at Melbourne University? You're lecturing and you're supervising masters, honours, PhDs. That's a lot of hard work. How are your next generation of top-class astronomers coming along in your institution where you work?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm incredibly privileged in my position because I get to work with many great people, but I get to work with a lot of great students as well. And the nice thing about astronomy is that it's kind of a gateway science. It gets everybody excited regardless of your background, I think. And so that means I get to interact with students not just in the bachelor degree or in master's or PhD, but, you know, I also get to meet students at high school and even in primary school. So you get kind of like a whole thing and everybody's always very excited about this. And that's just so rewarding to see people just kind of being like, awesome, right? It removes that barrier straight away where I think a lot of people come across to science and physics and stuff and they go, oh, it's very hard, I can't do this, right? And I understand, like, it's not easy and can be quite challenging, but, you know, astronomy just with those beautiful pictures just kind of removes that straight away to allow you people to kind of engage with it. And so I get that opportunity to kind of be like, look at all these awesome things we can look at and these fun things we can study, and then give them kind of the science behind it. And I, you know, it's a really nice thing to kind of just get them really, you know, just to see their eyes light up and kind of really get engaged. So I get to do a lot of outreach that allows me to do this and interact. But then, of course, you know, in my everyday job, I get to interact with these amazing students who are, you know, studying in their degrees, not necessarily going into astronomy or into physics, but, you know, engineering, who are just biomedical science and everything, who are really excited and come to look at physics at a completely different perspective from, you know, what I grew up, right? You know, some people want to do physics because they are interested in understanding, you know, flows of blood or air through lungs, right? And that can be attributed to biomed. And then you've got obviously engineers who need to know physics for, you know, building things. And so just kind of trying to talk to them and go through the learning process of different sciences or different physics with them, and seeing how you can adapt it so that such that so many different interests can still kind of engage and grab onto science is kind of really, really fun. So that, you know, means either in teaching, we get to teach one-on-one, where you get to talk to them at different outreach events or different, you know, just discussion, because, you know, I've had a number of students just come and talk to me about things because they think it's cool, or through kind of more, you know, traditional sitting in a public lecture or stuff. So, you know, probably the best part about my job, apart from being able to use telescopes and all this, is actually being able to work with a lot of students and kind of watch them on different levels, both in their research or in their studies, just kind of reaching their goals and being successful, because that's the most important thing is kind of raising them up that they can do this, because you can, right? And it's really, really rewarding to see them be able to achieve things that maybe they didn't think they could, and being able to really excel at them when they put their mind to it, being able to be a part of that process, guiding them through. It's just, it's quite magical.
Thanks, Kate. Now, this is a bit that I've been looking forward to hearing you talk about for quite a while now, because I've kept on going back to this resource. I found on the archive server a really amazing book that you've contributed to, and it's available for anyone to download from the archive server. And I'll provide a link to it at the end of the show. The book is called Astronomy as a Field, A Guide for Aspiring Astrophysicists. And it really is sensational. It pulls the whole field of astronomy apart, and it's a springboard to the stars. And I think it's going to be ground zero for a lot of young people getting into astronomy, and especially aspiring astrophysicists, which, you know, we all know is probably the best field. A mantra or a quote from Professor Priyamvada Natajaran, who's from Yale, and she put the header in one of her chapters, and it said, "I am capable of anything and everything that I put my mind to and put sincere effort into." Now, can you tell us about this book, please, Katie? It's just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book is, like you said, it is amazing, and I was lucky to be a part of it. And it's actually led by an amazing PhD student at Northwestern University called Ava Paulson. And so she actually coordinated this with a number of graduate students. So what is amazing about this document is that it's actually written essentially for anybody. It's supposed to be kind of like this resource that allows anybody to have the opportunity to kind of get into science, and particularly people who don't necessarily have access to resources, right? So, you know, say people who are in less privileged environments that can't buy a book or something like this. This is why it's publicly available, because I'm very particular about the idea that all these resources should be available to everybody. But Ava coordinated and led this book together with a lot of students who are listed at that in the document as well, where they wrote chapters about what they thought was important to be able to make that first fundamental step and get into astronomy. And they did an amazing job. So impressed and just like look up to these students for the work that they've done and effort and care that they put into this. So this book was actually led by, like I said, by Ava, who actually runs this organization called Cirrus B, which is essentially committed to good programming or good ideas that kind of target essentially underrepresented groups in STEM to allow them to have the opportunity to be able to have as much opportunity and resources available to them to get them into science. Because we do have a lack of, you know, we are struggling with, you know, underrepresented minorities in our sciences. We do, I know we're actively trying to put effort into improving that. But being able to offer a resource that you could give, for example, to maybe high school students or even primary school students who maybe don't have access to that, to just kind of get a taste that can then slowly build up to that, is, you know, very powerful. And so in this kind of this organizing committee, Cirrus B, which is called the Sharing Inclusive Research Instruction for Underrepresented Students Benefit, she put this together, or had the idea to put together, this primer for students interested in astronomy. And so this kind of what led to developing essentially this Astronomy as a Field of Guide for Aspiring Astrophysicists. And, you know, I was lucky to be able to help a little bit with this, but, you know, it was completely graduate-led, it's graduate student-led. It's a lot of great people who came together to show that, you know, these are the things that we needed. This is what is in a very accessible way of taking the information and being able to provide it for everybody to be able to use. It's an amazing resource.
Fantastic. Okay, well, here we are. Collaboration is the name of the game. What about outreach? You do a lot of outreach. I've found a lot of your material online. Is that an important part of being an astrophysicist?
I think it is. Personally, for myself, it's very, very important. You know, I'm very lucky to be in this position because I had a lot of, you know, to be able to do a PhD, for example, you get money from the government, so you're getting public support. To get to my position where I am, I've had a lot of support from many different groups who have supported me through my career. And so I think it's very important to be able to give back to the communities that allow me to be here. But also I think it's important that, you know, everybody should have access to science so that they can, you know, engage with it as much as they feel like they want and just kind of use it as a mechanism of exploring the world. And so if I can give a talk or talk about research or discuss kind of exciting things that we discover and be able to go out and learn or teach with people about these things, I think that's really exciting. And just like I said, just being able to see people engage and be really enthralled in this is kind of just amazing. You get really great questions, right, that you just sometimes don't even think about things. So you get kind of a different perspective. And so I think being able to give back to the community, being able to help them, be able to feel like that they can be a part of it and actually let them, you know, so it's not this kind of mystery. I think there's like, you know, a lot of science that you kind of see, for example, you know, the Big Bang Theory, it looks a little bit out of reach, right? Because you've got like a Sheldon thing that are kind of, you know, there are sure people probably like this, but, you know, you want people, but I feel like that puts a little people a little bit at arm's length. And this is kind of allowing people to be like, you can be here too. Let's go on the journey together and we can get you to a point. And that's what I really like to be able to do, is being able to say, yes, you know, first you say, oh, physics is too hard or whatever, right? And it's like, no, I understand. Yes, it is hard, but let's go on the journey together and we'll get you to that point, because that's what it is, right? Somebody helped me go from, you know, it's hard to be able to get there. And now can we do it as a community and be able to make it accessible for everybody, regardless of what their background is, and have those opportunities to do it if they're really excited. And, you know, I try to do as much as I can, right? But there are many great people whose job is doing this, and through the OSGRAV, which is the Center of Excellence related to gravitational waves that I'm a part of, they have a big community that do this as their job, and they do amazing work going into schools and trying to do this. So there are many people trying to be able to improve this. And so, you know, if I can contribute a small amount, I'm very happy to do this.
Well, we've come a long way since scientists used to write everything in Latin. Look, we're at the point now where the microphone's all yours, Katie. You've got the opportunity to give us your favourite rant or rave about, you know, anything you like. What is your favourite rant or rave at the moment?
So I'm a part of a lot of committees and a lot of mechanisms to try to improve the opportunity for underrepresented populations to be a part of science on this. And I think, because to me, I think this is one of the most important things to do, is that there's many axes of diversity, and we should make it accessible, science and university and education accessible as much as possible along all these axes of diversity, regardless of gender or, you know, your background, where you were born, or, you know, people are multifaceted, they have multi-axes of things that you don't really know when you first meet people, right? And they should not, you know, they don't have to necessarily tell you what they are. But I think it's important to be able to make it as easy as possible for all. One of the things I do is very much part of different committees that try to implement things at the university, or at least within the school that I work in, to try to improve the opportunities and, you know, accessibility for underrepresented groups. But one thing that I constantly hear is a lot of pushback against this. There are people that agree that we should be increasing diversity or allow people and providing the support for everybody. But there is, I think, a little bit of against that. They think it's not as not as important as doing research, right? For example, that it doesn't have the same weight, so that maybe they shouldn't put the effort into this. And, you know, of course you have people who are super convinced they'll put the effort into that. But really it should be a community effort. It is as important as research, because the people who do research is the people in the community and people that you have around you. And if you are only allowing, say, one type of individual, regardless of what that is, you're only getting a small subset of the community, right, who deserve to be, who should be there, right? So you're missing out on a huge amount of ideas, perspectives, backgrounds that can kind of come and look at science in a completely different way. And the thing is, like, I get to work with people all around the world, which means I get access to so many different individuals. And a science is not an individual thing, right? There is this idea of this lone scientist, like, because everybody looks at Einstein and says, oh, yeah, that's how science is. But absolutely, it is absolutely not this in any way, right? It is a community effort. I work with multiple people from multiple different backgrounds who have many different perspectives, many different resources, opportunities, you know, intersectionality on multiple dimensions of diversity. And that's what makes it rich, what makes science rich. And, you know, people saying it's not as important as that, and that they shouldn't do this, or I'm not going to put effort in, forgets the fact that they're in a community that has more people, that have multi-dimension, and that we really should be trying to make sure we work all together as possible and make it as easy as possible for all members of our community to be a part of that. And so that's kind of the main rant, is trying to convince people who may be on that border. It is as important. It should be on the same level, because you will interact with people from a huge amount of different communities, and we want to make sure that they feel welcome and supported to be able to be the best person they can be. Because without that support, without that community, people are not going to necessarily be able to succeed. We don't want that, right? There are a lot of already negative things in the world. We want to be able to do the best we can to make sure that anybody who gets the chance to try to do what we do or be a part of this can actually feel like they're supported and be positive and really engage in it. And I think, you know, having more people from more perspectives, regardless if you disagree with them, right, because that's also exciting to be able to talk about this, is that it provides the richness of our world, right? It's being able to learn about what many people have from many different cultures, right? That's supposed to be the nice thing about being in Australia, is that we have this melting pot, but at the same time, right, it's trying to be able to make sure we are not biasing to one group over the other, or if one group is not a part of it, what do we need to do to help them, bring them up so they feel like they can be a part of this? And, you know, we're trying to do as much as we can, but I think there does need to be a little attitude shift for some groups. So I would say that's probably the main thing at the moment that is trying to, you know, trying to deal with that a little bit.
Thank you, Katie. Now, just before we sign off, what are you keeping your eye on out there in the world of astronomy? What should we look out for in the near to mid future? What's on your radar?
So there's a few things. At the moment, what I'm really excited and what I think everybody should be looking at, and they're starting to get more and more now with time, is actually results coming from the James Webb Space Telescope. Though some of those are just mind-blowingly beautiful. And one I saw recently was actually by, there's a supernova remnant called Cassiopeia A, or Cass-A, where they took a lot of JWST imaging of this and they found all these amazing structures that we had not seen before. And so I think there's just going to be tons of really high-impact science for supernova, but high-redshift galaxies, understanding black holes, supernova. There's going to be a whole lot of range. So I think that's kind of like, you know, the medium-term thing is kind of looking at all that kind of information or data that's coming out. But also next year we'll have the Vera Rubin Observatory start, which is a huge telescope in Chile that's going to be monitoring the sky every night. And we're supposed to get thousands and thousands of alerts and interesting things that are coming in. So I think that's going to be kind of the next big thing, is trying to really piece together what is going on, what's exciting, you know, how do you process so many things at once, right? Like, you know, at the moment it's only a handful of things that we're dealing with every night, but if you have like 10,000, how do you get through all those? What is interesting and balancing them? And I think there's just going to be tons of science that are going to come out. That's, you know, it's going to be a complete treasure trove. So I'm excited for the future of what we get next.
Okay. Just before we go, listeners can freely download their own copy of Astronomy as a Field, a Guide for Aspiring Astrophysicists. It's all at tonyhill.com, Aspiring Astro, that's all lowercase, all one word. Thank you especially for your generosity. It's been amazing. Thank you so much, and good luck with your future ventures and with your little girl.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be able to talk to you. It's been wonderful.
And remember, AstroFiz is free and unsponsored. But we always recommend that you check out Dr. Ian Musgrave's AstroBlogger website to find out what's up in the night sky. See you in 2 weeks. Keep looking up.
Radio Wave!